You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network. Visit jabberjawmedia.com for more shows like this one.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Mr. Crash, is that your real name? I don't know. I should refer to you.
No, I get that a lot. It's not the name on my birth certificate, but it is pretty much what everyone calls me.
So. Right on. Well, Crash Thompson, welcome to the X-Man podcast.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it, man. That's super cool of you. I was going through some of your backlog here. You've been doing a lot of YouTubers here lately, haven't you?
I have, and I guess some of it is coincidental and some of it is on purpose. I just feel like there's so much more of the conversation starters and people, you know, listen, talking musicians is great, but it gets a bit repetitive, and I don't know, I feel like I have the way my brain works, I probably feel like I have a lot more in common with kind of the vloggers and the media people and kind of the punditry class. I guess I feel like I identify with a lot.
Oh, that's cool, man. That's cool. I can appreciate that. I bet it does get repetitive talking to musicians all the time. I bet, you know, a lot of the same stuff kind of gets tossed around here and there.
So. Yeah, well, it's you have similar arcs, and I have traditional X-Man shows, which, you know, ultimately are the most popular stuff I do. If I get, you know, like I had the drummer from Korn, David Silvera, on here.
Oh, yeah.
And people hadn't heard from him. And stuff like that tends to really get people excited because that was really the concept of the show. You know, but it's tough to find people that people haven't really spoken to or you haven't heard their story. So it's a little bit like, you know, Indiana Jones over here.
Yeah, that's to say, yeah, a lot of those, let's say you're digging around for the people who, I mean, by this point, especially like guys like David Silvera and stuff, they've gotten the chance to sort of talk and spread their stories around.
But he hasn't.
So I get that.
But that's what I'm saying. Like some people you would think it's out there, but it's really not. So it's, it's a lot of that is coming from my own taste and also my background, the bands I'm friends with, the bands I got into. So, you know, but with that said, it's stuff like this. I want to kind of periodically do topical stuff just because it's like, oh, you know, there's a new Tool record and people want to hear about Tool.
Oh yeah, I know. Believe me, that's been paying off big time for me here lately. Say all the Tool videos I've done here recently have probably brought in the biggest boom the channel's ever seen. I've gotten something like 3,000, 4,000, somewhere in that range, subscribers just within the past month.
So how many Tool videos did you do?
I did in a lead up, like about 2 weeks before the new album dropped, I did a video called How to Get Into Tool, which basically went over their whole discography and kind of just talked a little bit about each album, which ones might be, you know, the best places to start and which ones might be a little more kind of out there, maybe a little esoteric, whatever. That gained me a lot of traffic. And then when I finally did drop my Fear Inoculum review, that sort of doubled the traffic I was already getting from the first Tool video. So
Right on, yeah. I wish I would have caught up on that. Now I feel behind the ball. But
dude, it's okay. Like I say, the tool video, the how to get into is like a 40-minute video, and my Fear Inoculum review ended up being like 10 minutes long, even though I tried to make that one as short as I could. But no, I get it, man. It's, you know, say we.
Well, anyway, so I just want to talk about your page to begin with. I mean, I don't even know how I ended up following your stuff, but you know, I'm a big fan of the style that you've put together. Everything seems very well thought out. I don't know if you write it out, but it seems like it is written in advance. I love your editing style. It's very entertaining, even if I disagree with your take on a particular album. The way you present it is always really well done.
Oh, thank you very much. I sincerely appreciate that. Yeah, believe me, I write all of this stuff out. I am a slave to the script. I don't know the way I try to make it seem as, you know, off the cuff and as, you know, sort of not so strictly adhered to, you know, a die cut scripting sort of process as possible. I make it feel as relaxed and casual as I can.
Yeah.
But in my experience, I'm just not very good at improv. So
how many words is a normal review?
A normal review is probably, usually it's about a one pager on Google Docs. So I would say that's probably between 500 to 700.
Okay, words, not bad.
I would say. Yeah, somewhere in that ballpark.
I'm verbose, so.
Believe me. I know, I have to limit myself to one page usually on most of the scripts I write. So
how did you get started doing reviews? Was it on YouTube, or you're doing written reviews and stuff like that beforehand?
I actually did get started on YouTube. It's weird. I was actually following the style of a lot of people who didn't talk about music mostly. There are a lot of other people in the sort of YouTube critical sphere. A lot of early influences to me, guys like The Nostalgia Critic. I don't know if you've ever heard of him.
Yeah, I don't know he did music.
That's the thing. He doesn't. There were a lot of other guys like Spoony and Brutal Moose. And I know there's a whole scene of reviewers out there. Although the thing is, back when I started doing it about 7 or 8 years ago, there were a lot of people talking about stuff like video games and movies and TV and other stuff. No one was talking about music. Like there were a few guys, Fantano was just getting started, and there were a few people who were really, really small at the time, but that general reviewer type scene was all like, you know, was other mediums. It was games and movies and stuff. I just saw that there was no one talking about music, so I figured, you know, no, nobody else is doing this, right? Can I do this? Can I get away with doing this? I'm going to do this if nobody else is going to do this, so.
It's funny.
So I just.
No, yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no, you're fine.
No, I was saying it's funny because I feel like the critic's role, especially in, actually, I would actually even broaden it beyond just rock music, has really evolved over the years.
And absolutely.
You go back to, like, I read Questlove's book, for example, and he became obsessed with Rolling Stone's review section and really looked at it as a benchmark, you know, for, you know, pop music in general, whether it's a Prince record or the Police or what, you know, whatever was going on, that was his kind of, you know, North Star in a lot of ways. And going back to when I came up with my old band, God Forbid, you know, it was all about, can you get 5Ks in Kerrang? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and even certain websites, you know, some of which are no longer with us. There was one called Metal Judgment back in the day that, you know, I always liked stuff that seemed to have, that was rigorous and there was standards and obviously wasn't just handing out good reviews for no reason.
Oh, yeah.
And I felt like it had an impact, you know, that if you were well reviewed in a certain publication or website, that it lent a certain amount of credibility with, you know, at least with the metal scene, it's very nerdy, you know, so there is that kind of gatekeeper intelligentsia mentality to a lot of stuff. I mean, what would you say the role is now? Cause I feel like, cause you did a piece on Pitchfork, you know, but I feel like that's one of the only places I hear about oh, Pitchfork said this about this record. And it's usually, it's not about our scene. It's usually, it's like some hip hop record or something like
that. Yeah. I don't, well, the whole Pitchfork thing just came about. Well, you know, being a big music nerd, of course, I always read a lot of those sites, you know, coming up, and just, I don't know. That's the thing. Pitchfork was always just like an easy target, you know, just some of the reviews that they did. They've gone down in sort of like, you know, sort of music nerd legend for how sort of bad or weird some of them can be. So it's like, I don't know, it's one of those things I've never seen anyone do like a full-blown video on, which does surprise me, because there was that was fertile ground to tap. I could probably make 3 or 4 more Pitchfork videos. I could probably mine that little source alone just for ages if I absolutely wanted to. But do you think
people care like about those, or just in general, or is it YouTube? Where are people paying attention to the, you know, giving the thumbs up or thumbs down about this stuff?
I think people sort of care. They care. I feel like they care more than they do. Maybe it's weird. There isn't so much the whole, like it used to be, like way back in the day, like you were saying, with Questlove and his situation. He, you know, sort of obsessed over Rolling Stone, and you know, way back in the day, well, not even that far back in the day, but it was more like certain outlets, you know, you kind of had to get their sort of stamp of approval. Well, like again, and like you mentioned, like if you were a hip hop artist, getting that thumbs up from Pitchfork meant a lot.
Or the source,
another big one for there. Back before aggregation became a thing, getting certain spots, you know, getting the big, you know, getting Rolling Stone to give you that thumbs up, or getting Alternative Press to give you that thumbs up. You know, it was like, oh, okay, yeah, now we're legit. Now that's the big one. With you know, the advent of Metacritic and even other sites like, you know, Rotten Tomatoes and other, now that all of the reviews are being culled together into that scary numeric average, I feel like the individual review isn't quite as potent as the collective reviews, yeah. You know, or what your average ends up. Like I say, that Metacritic number score in the video game industry, like there have actually been reported cases of, you know, companies withholding bonuses from their employees, or actually giving out bonuses to their employees if the game they released met a certain Metacritic score. Like, we're releasing the game on Thursday, if it gets an 84 or higher, then you guys get your bonus. If not, well, better luck next time. You know, it's...
That seems a little bit unethical, because I feel like you could get... Oh, yeah. You know, inner dealing and weird incentives, and this idea that, you know, I don't know the video game industry from an insider's perspective, but, you know, I don't know what is there a direct correlation between rating and commercial success?
Not necessarily. I mean, some games, I feel like the games that do better on the aggregate scores do tend to sell particularly well. Again, it's a whole, you know, people get more exposure to it, and, you know, a higher number, even if it is from a smaller developer or anything like that, a higher number does still get you some recognition and it gets you some clout. But I don't know, what's the thing that really hurts are those, like I say, those lower numbers. Like and the thing is too, like it's such, like, I don't think it's a good metric to measure something's quality by. But at the same time, though, there have been a lot of instances, again, with this is more of a game. This is more of a games and especially movies kind of thing, where, you know, something will get a lot of universal praise, but then one notable critic will come out of the blue and say, I thought it was mediocre, you know, 6 out of 10 or whatever. And then there, less than glowing review brings the number down. That can actually bring about a weird sense of audience backlash. This happened to a guy, a video game critic named Jim Sterling. He runs the Jimquisition. It's this big thing. Breath of the Wild was one of the last big Zelda games, and that game was getting like 10s across the board. 10 out of 10, 10 out of 10, game of the year. Just every single outlet that could gave that game a perfect score. And then Jim comes along, sees some stuff he doesn't like, has some legitimate gripes about things, gives it like an 8, out of 10, you know, which is still a very good score. You know, that's still a very, very good score. But the fact that he gave it an 8 instead of the perfect 10 that it was supposed to get, he actually ended up getting death threats. He got doxxed. He got...
Jesus.
Yeah, a lot of stuff. Over an eight, not even a negative review, but a review that wasn't positive enough. So in some extreme cases, you certainly can get stuff like that. But also, again, I feel like because of what aggregation has done to the review scene in general, it's, you know, it's made it more so that if you're going to twist the knife, if you're going to publish a bad review, You better make sure you cite your sources and you know where you're coming from with that, because again, that can have so much more dramatic consequences than it did like 10 years ago. You know, I mean, Robert Christgau could write a negative review about an album everybody loved, and you know, they would just be like, oh, what is he talking about? What a doofus. You know, that would usually be the worst thing he'd have to worry about.
Yeah,
these days it's
interesting. I have a kind of different take on music reviewing in general, because I think with my direct comparison to say film or television, where I feel like in film and television, the actual mechanics of making something work functionally are much more difficult to do. So it's easier to make a bad film than I think it is to make bad music. Like, you can essentially, you know, record it properly and have it played well and sung well and performed well. And so, like, the benchmark is a little lower. So then it becomes, I think it, so at that point, it does become more subjective with music. I notice with music, I might like an album if I just listen to it in a different mood or a different time of day or when I'm not tired or, you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Or like, have headphones on as opposed to living in my car. You know what I'm saying? Like
Oh, absolutely. Well, 100%. That's the thing. Music, thankfully, in the music scene, at least, we don't see quite as much of that sort of reactionary stuff. Again, because music is such a subjective experience, you know? It's not something that can be boiled down to, like, very specific factors. You know, if a game doesn't control properly, you can map that out and says, oh, when I push the button, the thing doesn't happen. That's a very clear-cut fault. If a movie has shitty cinematography and blurry vision, you can write, oh, this part of the film is blurry. That's a bad. I don't like that. With music, it's hard to even, again, because tastes are so subjective and so broad, too. It's like, I mean, you know, you could say something like, oh, the Ramones, oh, it's too simple, it's too simplified, they're just playing power chords, it's just, you know, this is baby's first stuff, you know, but at the same, you could technically say that, but at the same time, like, it's more like, okay, there's so much more that goes into it, you know, and there's also just the fact that, well, music is such a subjective thing. You can hammer down the finer points of other medias a lot more finely than you can with music. Music, it either kind of connects to you and it speaks to you, or it doesn't.
Yeah, it's inherently emotional.
And yeah, exactly. There's an inherent emotional factor to every piece of music that goes out there. And the thing is, too, if you look at, like, Metacritic, you can actually go on most aggregate sites like Metacritic or AllMusic and whatnot and look through their reviews for an entire year or for, like, an entire decade or whatever. You know, you'll look at, like, the movies, all the movies they've aggregated for the year. You'll see, like, a decent amount of greens, you know, a decent amount of greens, a decent amount of yellows, and a decent amount of reds. Same thing with games, same thing with TV. All across the board, you'll see a pretty even split. But when it comes to music, there's, like, almost a 90%, it's almost like 90% green. Then maybe you'll get like 10% yellow, like for some of the worst stuff of the year. And the stuff that's just really, really, really bad, the rarest cases in aggregate sites is when you'll ever see any red. I think the last red album I saw was that one Corey Feldman put out a couple of years back.
But that's what I'm saying. I think a lot of it is preordained in some respects. Like, for example, I think there's this distinction between a band that does well critically and a band that, or not even band, just an artist that is kind of well liked by the, you know, by the kind of the populism, the populist version. Oh, yeah. So, give an example, like a band like, or someone like Kid Rock, where I imagine that if that came across the desk of, you know, some, you know, some Brooklyn.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, well, cool. You put that on Pitchfork's desk, you can tell what's going to happen.
Exactly. To it, but that's what I'm saying. It's kind of this weird thing where we're living in different worlds, whereas opposed to, you know, I imagine Radiohead could, you know, fart on a fucking, you know, in a forest, you know, and record it with an iPhone and it would get, you know, A plus.
I'd probably still have to give it at least an 8 out of 10. You know?
Yeah. And I think that, so it's funny, like with the metal world, I feel like I've gotten further and further away from like something like Decibel or a lot, because it's the same kind of bands. It'll be a pallbearer or, you know, what's that other band? The black metal kind of major key black metal band. Death Heaven.
Death Heaven. Yeah.
Listen, I think those are all great bands. I'm not trying to undermine what they do, but there's a predictability of we like this kind of musical aesthetic. We like it coming from these kinds of record labels. We kind of like bands that look kind of like this and carry themselves in a certain way. And there's a anti-commercialist sentiment, you know, kind of baked into it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. I feel like a lot of the music... that's the thing. A lot of the music reviewing circles out there, you know, they tend to review more towards... Like a film or a game has to reach to the broadest audience possible. You know, you're making a movie in the hopes that everyone from any background will usually enjoy it. I mean, there are niche filmmakers out there, but at the same time, it's... You know, most of the time, people who are out there pushing movies out are hoping to get everybody on board, no matter where you come from or what your background is. Music is a lot more niche, you know? It's more, you know, like a lot of, like you say, Pitchfork is not going to waste their time on a Kid Rock album. And at the same coin, CCM probably isn't going to spend too much time with like a Metallica record or, you know, anything like that. So, you know, and, you know, music tends to sort of stick in certain lanes more closely than film and other mediums do. So again, I feel like that's also a contributing factor to why, you know, it's not quite as harsh in the musical critical sphere, at least, you know, in a general sense. Again, you know, it's like, you know, your average CCM reader doesn't want to read about metal. Your average metal user doesn't want to read about like country and, you know, other stuff. So people tend to kind of stay in their lanes a little bit better when it comes to the music scene. I don't know. That's just what I've observed, at least.
Yeah, I agree. So we've gone about 20 minutes. We barely talked about Tool. So let's get into this record. So not to speak for you, but you gave a fairly glowing review. So just to kind of repeat for our my audience, you want to kind of tell them what you thought about the record?
I absolutely loved it. I actually gave that record a 5 out of 5, which is pretty much the best score I can give on my show. It's honestly going to be an album of the year candidate for me, if not the album of the year candidate. I don't know. That's part of the problem. It's been a really, really good year for a lot of rock and metal and heavier sort of genre. The rock genre in general, you know, has been pretty good. We've gotten a lot of decent records out there.
Are there any others off the top of your head that are you like this year?
Oh, just a few. The new Moron Police was a surprisingly good one. I did not see that one coming out of absolutely nowhere. The new Slipknot was also great. Yeah, that new Slipknot. I expected the new Slipknot to be pretty good, but not as good as it ended up being.
Like, you know what's really good, actually? The new Korn.
Yeah, so I've heard.
Like, it might be their best record in forever. Like, it's really good.
Yeah, that's what I keep hearing. I'm not the biggest Korn fan in the world. I've just never really gotten into them. I'll have to give this one a try.
Well, that's the thing. It's like you said, it's niche. I mean, music. Yeah. It's like either you get a band or it either works for you, it does. I've always been a Korn fan, so I'm really. Yeah. But it feels doesn't feel like they're just going paving over ground that's already happened. It does feel like they're just trying to be a band in the now that still sounds like Korn. So that's what I like about it.
It's very interesting. It's got some balls to it. I will definitely have to check that out when I get a chance. So I'm not promising anything, but I will certainly, like I say, Korn is just one of those bands. Again, music is a thing that's just got to click with you personally. God help me, for some reason, Korn has just never clicked with me.
So with Tool, it's interesting Tool. Because I got into Tool in high school, you know, seeing the Sober video, but it really clicked, but it clicked from, you know, and I bought that record, and I pretty much liked the singles, you know, from Undertow. And then, even though I would listen to the record, but it was really with Enema that I really got drawn in. And I think a lot of, you know, I was, you know, 16 or something when that record came out. And, you know, I remember back then, like, if you were into that record, you kind of felt like you were really deep and like a philosopher, you know, like you were.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, listen, man, this is operating other levels, bro. Like, you really... You know, you got to absorb this, you know, and
there's layers to it, dude. Yeah, it's like an onion, man.
And it's still my favorite Tool record. But obviously they became what they've become, which is this iconic band that really lives outside of the normal rules of what other bands can do. And I find a parallel. I mentioned Radiohead earlier, but I do think there's a parallel that without Sober, right, and same thing with Radiohead, without Creep, they couldn't have become, and getting that mainstream appeal and having the big single that's on on TV and on the radio to bring in all the regular kind of average Joes, then they couldn't have gone as deeply down the rabbit holes as they've gone and been so experimental. And for some reason, they've not only been able to keep the majority of this audience, it's created this other thing where the fans they do have are like 10 times more loyal than other fans. It's really a cult.
I like to call that the Rush effect. You know, it's basically just once you get into this band, once you become a fan of this band, you basically become die hard. It's almost like NASCAR fandom. You know, once you get into it, you ain't going anywhere. You just connect with it on such a huge level. And like you say, it is because like most people, when they get into Tool, they discover so much within their music. You know, it's stuff that you can enjoy on that raw, visceral, just punchy rock, ass rock kind of level. But if you want to dig deeper into it, there is so much more you can find if you want to. And when you do, man, it most of the time it is quite the wonderful little head trip. So
yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think how many times I've listened to the new record. It's probably I'm probably on like my fourth or fifth time listening through it completely, because it's one of those things. Yeah. It's obviously really long, so it's difficult to listen to it in one sitting.
Exactly.
But you know, I'm kind of like, I would be that, like that one review you mentioned, I'd probably the one to give it an 8 or a 7, because I feel like it does lack that kind of standout track, like you know, like The Pot or you know, what was the Vicarious, you know, these
Vicarious,
ones.
Vicarious,
you know, or, you know, or, and the, what was Lateralis? What was the big,
Schism.
Schism, you know. Yeah. But just having like that one or two tracks, because, you know, the like I said, these, all, almost every track, with the exception of Tempest, is a slow burn, and it really lulls you in, and it takes a while to get in, and it, you know, has this kind of sinewy, you know, burrowing in your brain, and you're in a hypnotic feel, you know, and it's like, for example, are you a weed smoker?
Occasionally.
Okay, so you're not like one of these dudes that's like, hey man, fucking Tool, man, you ain't listening to it right, man.
Oh, no, man. maybe in my post-college days, but I'm past that now.
So. Okay. Yeah. See, but I haven't gotten high and listened to the record, so maybe I'm not getting it on the right frequency. Or this shit, you probably have to, like, get some acid and, you know, when it's like a full moon, and then, like, you know, rub like a plant or something. I don't know.
Yeah. You have to put on one of Bill Hicks's albums at 12:53 a.m. on a full moon. That's in the middle of October 23rd, and then it'll click for you. After a handful of mushrooms and two dabs of LSD, then you get it.
Yeah, but I have noticed it's because every song was so long and dense, it almost, I feel like I get more out of each song when I hear them individually, as opposed to like when you hear like track 8 after hearing everything, you feel a little, I feel a little beat down by it, and it feels very samey. But if you hear it right on its own, you're like, fuck, this is really cool. That's just my experience with it.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like the Lumineers, Ani DeFranco, Wolf Peck, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask? Good morning.
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon.
Hello out there!
Yes, hello out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together, we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hyden, Backstreet's magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Menahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to None But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform, and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!
Hey you, do you have any plans this year? How's that going? Did you get 2020? Well, welcome to a brand new podcast called 2020, where myself, Benny Goodman, and my good friends Corey Pazin and Siobhan Cronin from the band Lost Symphony also got 2020.
And since the world ended this year, we decided why not just check in with some of our friends in the music industry and see how everyone's doing.
We're going to get a candid look at life on and off the stage, as well as the mindset of some of the most successful people in the entertainment industry.
New episodes drop every Sunday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And you can listen at 2020-D.com, SoundTalentMedia.com, or on your favorite podcast app.
Yeah, and to a degree, I absolutely agree with that. That's the thing with this album. It's a challenge. Like you said, there isn't a full blown single on this record. To be honest, it's an album that demands a lot out of you. Like I say, all of the songs with their huge crushing length and with the sweeping scopes that it goes to, and the more repetitive, the more hypnotic sort of appeal. And also the fact that, you know, this is one of their, I hesitate so strongly to use this word, but one of their softest records. It's not a soft record by any means, but by Tool standards, you know, these are the same guys who gave us like Bottom and, you know, and Anima and, you know, all of these other huge and maddeningly just thick pounding songs. And there isn't really that. There isn't really a lot of that on this record at all. And the moments where it does show up, it's usually like the sort of midway point or the closing point of like Invincible or like you say, Tempest at the very tail end of the record, when it finally does start to pick up a little bit. But you've had to have settled in for a good, you know, 10 minutes. The build that they tried to establish on this is so dense and just huge, and like I say, it can be a lot to take in one setting. But I don't know, the thing with me was I was digging that 150%, because again, I just loved the ride of this album. This album just a lot of normal albums will sort of peak and valley, you know, it'll have its, you know, sort of higher moments, but then it'll like maybe lull, you know, maybe some slower tracks or maybe some filler here or there. I don't know. But, you know, it's more of a sort of up and down kind of experience. With Tool or with Fear Inoculum, it's such a concentrated sort of complete. You are literally just locked into, it's not so much a roller coaster as it is, what would I compare it to? Like being strapped in, being strapped into like a roller coaster car, but being led down a hallway full of psychedelic imagery and just crazy, mind trippy, head fucky, hypnotizing stuff, as opposed to just leaps and swoops and whoops and whatnot.
You know what it kind of reminds me of?
Hmm.
2001: A Space Odyssey.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
that film that's a great is kind of. You know, I think when it came out, it was just an experience. It was pushing things, the boundaries of what we could do with film. But it is kind of a slog. It's a little overlong. It has shots that go on maybe about 5 to 10 seconds longer than you would think. Does things that really are all about feel and mood and, you know, just taking its time with things. And you're kind of left with it like, oh, is this what they're trying to do? Is it, what am I supposed to be getting out of this? So it reminds me of that. And maybe someone should like cut that together, make a condensed version of that film set to this album.
Yeah, exactly. I'll bet it's like the Pink Floyd and Wizard of Oz thing. I bet if you play this with 2001 at the right moment, I bet the whole film syncs up with the album perfectly. What do you want to bet?
All right. Well,
somebody needs to dig that up.
All right. Well, I'm sure someone will figure it out too, considering how, invested and inventive tool fans.
I'm sure
are.
Somebody's already thrown that up on YouTube somewhere or something, but.
But what do you think? So the thing that's interesting to me about this band is there's so much commercial, when I say commercial success, I just mean the album sales and the ticket sales and the merchandise and we see the streaming numbers that they're finally showing up that, everyone else is conditioned to like, all right, here's the album cycle. We have to have a new album every, 18 to 24 months. We can't stop. We have to just constantly be doing this. So much of the music industry is obviously a visual medium. It's surrounded by star power and personality. And this band essentially breaks every rule of what, a manager would tell a band to do to succeed. And it's working more. I mean, they sold more records than Slipknot. They are playing the same venues as Slipknot, but selling them out quicker, doing multiple nights. I mean, I heard the entire tour sold out. People are reselling tickets for, a lot of money. What do you think is special about them, and why is the rest of the industry not really taking any notes from this, or should we even? I don't know.
It's hard to tell with Tool again, because I don't know their success. It's such a hard thing to track or put a number. It's a hard thing to really guess or gauge, because Tool, like you say, they broke almost all of the rules when it comes to, video making and album making, everything that, everything that a band is supposed to do to be successful in this industry, they didn't. And they still draw in all of those figures and whatnot. I have theories, but
give me at least one theory.
I hate to point back to it again, but one of my theories again has a lot to do with the appeal of a band like Rush, for example. Rush also did a lot of those same sort of things. They were doing a lot of stuff, they were doing long songs, they were doing these huge experimental mind fucks that were, nothing at all what, the scenes of their time demanded whatsoever. But again, they were still able to make that money and to get their songs on the radio and to get people to demand to see them and hear them all over the place. I think a lot of in parallel to Rush and Tool, I would say there are a few factors here that sort of play. In one case, it's a sense of fearlessness. Like, when you listen to a Tool record, it just is the fact that, they will do whatever the bloody hell they like on a record. And, that's the thing. That's become the thing that people come to Tool for, the unexpected experience. They've been able to turn that into their – I mean, a band like – like a band like Green Day, you know, no matter, even if they want to expand, even if they want to experiment, a lot of people are going to walk into a Green Day album with certain expectations, you know, oh, it should be pop punky. It should be, you know, it should have, you know, this kind of guitar style. It should have this kind of this kind of drumming and this kind of melody. There's certain expectations, you know, and a lot of times if, you know, a band deviates from those expectations, it can be kind of crushing. A lot of the worst, a lot of the worst reviewed albums and a lot of the worst reviews I've had to give personally are to bands that, you know, when they try to step outside of that formula, but they either don't commit enough or it's just not a very good idea, and it just ends up just kind of tanking.
That
and
new
kabooming.
Green Day song is weird.
Yeah, no, I was kind of feeling the same way about it. It grows on me the more I listen to it.
It just
I gotta
doesn't
admit,
sound like Green Day. I don't know who to, like. They should sell that to Black Keys or something.
Yeah, no. See, exactly. That's that whole mentality at work. You know, Green Day trying to step outside of those boundaries of what, you know, people expect them to do. And, you know, people are – and again, it's already generating some backlash because it's not what we're familiar with. With Tool, they were just completely breaking boundaries pretty much from day one.
But they've always sounded like Tool. That's the thing is I almost was actually distinct about this record is that – it's in many ways from a sonics standpoint, just the actual sounds you're hearing. There's really nothing new on this. There's for me, there's not like, oh, there. Yeah. The only thing I've noticed is different is there seems to be a little bit more lead guitar work. I noticed like there's like these extended sections where Adam Jones really kind of lets loose a little bit in his way, not like a, you know, Van Halen solo.
Exactly.
But other than that, it is within a very definable context of like, we're Tool, we do this sound. They're really not, even though, like I said, the fearlessness has to do with, hey, we're going to have a fucking, hip hop break or we're going to have a country part. It's not that experimental. It's more like, we're going to express ourselves how we feel within this particular sandbox. But the thing that kind of I think about when I listen to this band, and especially when I think about the length of time between records, is I think the only way a band that's that successful, and keep in mind, like you mentioned in your review, you're like, yeah, they kind of went away. No, they didn't. They never stopped touring. They've never stopped being an active band, which says they were functioning. There was an economy. There was still the business of Tool was something that was happening. But to me, when just knowing what it's like to be in a band, I see 13 years, and I'm like, that's a group of people that had barricades creatively between someone wanting to do X and someone else wanting to do Y and them trying to figure out how to find some middle ground.
And a lot of the articles I read about the whole production process of this album, I did see a lot of that. They did talk about how there was a lot of strife. There was a lot of conflict and conflicting visions between the guys at certain segments. There was that factor to it. The band has all but admitted about that. There was also like a lot of legal stuff that came up too. Something with their management. They were suing their management at the time. There was some personal stuff that came up too. So obviously this was a lot of stuff came up with the guys that sort of threw a lot of wrenches into this. Add on top of that the fact that Tool's writing process, at least the way we understand it, is a very long and cumbersome and very involved sort of process. So again, I get where that comes from, and I don't doubt that this was a difficult record for them to make, for sure. You can almost kind of see that in the final product we got. Again, there are these songs that just go on forever and ever, and all of these different sort of shifts and different soundscapes and different things that just sort of come in, sort of ebb in and out of each other. It's a very strange album. You can kind of feel the tension in it, but at the same time, like, yeah, I would definitely say that's a factor into the final products that we got here. But I don't know. At the same time, it is just. Tool were touring. They were doing their thing. You know, they were trying to stay as active as they possibly could. But To a lot of people out there, at the end of the day, they didn't release, they didn't release an album, they didn't release an EP. Even for a band like Tool that takes their sweet time, 13 years is still a long time. So you could definitely feel the sting of that as it came about. But.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of appreciate that idea of, I'm always into less is more, I think, with bands. I get annoyed at some of my favorite bands that put out albums too frequently, and it comes up on my podcast a lot, because I'll bring certain guys. I'm like, hey, man, I love you guys, man, but you did this one record, and then you had another record out a year later, and it wasn't as good, which tells me you didn't let the juices, you didn't let that reservoir refill and allow yourself to kind of change enough as a human being to warrant the idea. And I think in this almost kind of SoundCloud era, where a lot of creators tend to just, whatever comes out, they just release.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And, which tells me with Tool, there's a real rigorous process of saying, what is actually going to make it to the, what's going to make it on a record? What's going to actually pass this certain benchmark, that it seems like they have very, very, very high standards for what they consider something that is releasable under the moniker Tool. I mean, obviously you have someone like Maynard, who is has several different bands, all of which are very good. That he's clearly not like cutting corners or doing anything like that. But he is someone that appears to want to be consistently productive, and putting out, going that long between albums is, I imagine with any creative person, it would be very frustrating.
Oh, absolutely. But at the same time, you, like you mentioned, it's, you see, Tool takes their sweet time with the albums they put out, but those albums, like, you can usually, you could totally, it was about 6 years between Lateralis and 10,000 Days, but you can feel the 6 years of development between those albums. Like, you can, I can understand the argument. Like, I can totally understand the argument of, okay, well, is this album 13 years good? Even I wouldn't say, as much as I love this album, even I wouldn't say, maybe it shouldn't have taken 13 years, but you can still feel that this was something they pained over. This was something they agonized over. This was something that, like, this was a fine sculpture. This was not just a hedge trimming, you know. They took their sweet time and made sure this album was as chiseled and as ready to go as they could possibly get it. Like, the whole and especially in these days, like you mentioned, the whole sort of higher turnaround rate for certain artists out there. Dude, you're talking to a Weezer fan right now. And Weezer, with what they've been doing the whole thing where they're just releasing, a new album every year. Hell, they're releasing two albums next year, I believe. And, like, man, you can totally tell, like, especially in the quality of their last couple of records, it's just like, you can just tell, like, they're not taking the time to sort of rest up, to get themselves sort of creatively juiced, creatively psyched, to think of new ideas and interesting directions to go. It's just, it's time, you know. It's been 12 months. We got to put out the record. We got to flow through the cycle, you know. It's a lot of acts, especially because the more you output these days, at least in terms of, like, records or EPs, the more, like, content you throw out there, the more stuff you have to make money with, you know. I mean, the more songs you have out there on Spotify, the more people can potentially stream it, or, you know, whatever, what have you. It's again, the system kind of rewards a high productivity sort of rate without, you know, at the same time, a lot of artists aren't, there are some artists out there that do this thing. Actually, my buddy Mark over at Spectrum Pulse, I think he came up with this term. It's called stream trolling, where an artist like, I hate to put anyone on the spot, but like the last Migos record, That ended up being like a three LP, like a three, like a basically a triple album, like three CDs worth of material. But like a good 80% of it was mostly just like filler and skits and other stuff. Again, just because it's volume and
you get paid per stream.
You get paid per stream, and the more time people are spending there, I mean, the more time people are spending there, the more you're raking in. So again, it's a big part of the reason why Drake's last album was so long. It's a big reason why a lot of people are just, pumping out so much stuff constantly. We're seeing a lot more stuff like EPs and mixtapes, and also in the 2000s and the late 90s and whatnot. Like, I don't know, after like Jar of Flies and like Sap, how many big EPs did you see circulating around in those days? These days, it is not uncommon at all for artists to release an EP. To release an album a year every 6 months something like that.
Greta Van Fleet had a lot of success with their EPs. And then Ghost has actually done really well with their EPs in between records. That's just looking at record sales. I know some bands like Hailstorm, I think they do like cover EPs between albums. And listen, I think it's every band, every apparatus is different, kind of going back to your Weezer thing, just what I know about Rivers Cuomo, the way kind of his internal process is that he personally likes validation. So he's really into the idea of like, hey, I recorded this thing, I put it out, and then I get instant feedback on my creation. And I think that's something that works for him. And I think also, and this is a little head shrinky on my end, I do think within that operation there, there's a real effort to kind of maintain quote unquote relevance in the modern sense. So I think that's relevant when, because Weezer, they're a big band, but they're not Green Day. They're not Metallica. And so they kind of might have to fight a little more for their space in that kind of, the pop world in big sense. Because the truth is, the pop world is left behind rock music in a real big way from a, hey, you're invited to the party. And it must feel weird when you were invited to the party and you liked it. And all of a sudden, you're not getting. They ain't calling you to come to the VMAs anymore. They're not calling you to come to the Grammys anymore. And I think that might have a psychological effect on you, where it's like, where you might become a little more desperate about. All right, we gotta have to constantly doing this. We have to kind of keep up with the Joneses, so to speak.
Oh yeah. I can understand where you're coming from here. Again, especially with the sort of downturn in rock, especially lately the past 10 years. I mean, how many times a year do we get on whatever music site you want to pick, how many times a year do we get the, is rock and roll finally dead? Or, oh, rock is dead, here's what's replacing it, or, something like that. I can understand how that would totally, especially from a business standpoint, everyone's talking about doom and gloom in your industry. It's like, really? I'm in a rock band. Car tug, well, are you sure it's dead? Because
Well, I think it's really functioning in different planes. A good friend of mine, Finn McKenty, who has the Punk Rock NBA YouTube page, just did a video basically talking about how rock is dead or shot or is falling behind. And I think he makes a lot of really great points, but I do think what's happening, and me, I'm in a band that's one of the more successful newer rock/metal bands. And I see that it's just an older crowd, I think when young people are into what you're doing, it has a different imprint culturally. And it feels different, and it feels more exciting, and it's going to. So if you look at certain things like streams, pop and hip hop are going to crush rock because young people are the ones who are streaming and have really embraced it in a certain way. That's their medium. You know, but if you look at, you know, ticket sales, you know, everyone's kind of doing good. But I think the biggest problem with rock is that if you're an older band, you're fucking doing great. You're kicking ass. You're selling tickets. You're still selling records. You're selling merch. Also, your business is probably pretty good. I think where the main thing is, like, what's up with new bands, young artists? How are we developing them? How are we supporting them? How are we finding the next cool thing? You know, because think about it. So many of the young bands are really kind of, you know, putting out a retro aesthetic. You know, you look at a band like Greta Van Fleet. You look at a band like Power Trip, you know, a metal band who sounds, you know, that sounds like they're from the early 90s or something. A lot of the stuff that's really, you know, Code Orange is another band that made a lot of noise who kind of sounds like a metalcore band from the late 90s, like when I came up. So there's this idea that even the young bands are hanging their hat on this thing of the past. And we don't really, you know, I remember for a few years, I'd be talking to A&R guys and dudes, man, like, what do you think is the next big thing? And I don't know what was the next big thing if it ever came along.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. That's kind of the thing with rock. Like, I don't know. It's gone through a lot of shifts in state, especially when it was especially when it did have more of a place in the mainstream. You know, we went through grunge in the 90s, went through some sort of the post-grunge thing. And as the 90s went on, like new metal came around, then garage rock got really big, and like the White Stripes and Jack White's whole thing. Then somewhere around
we had emo too, the My Chemical Romances and emo, Fall Out Boy.
Like there were always rock scenes, and it would always change and sort of develop as to what became the popular thing in rock. Then I don't know, somewhere around that garage rock, somewhere around like, I'd say like maybe when the Black Keys sort of started getting super duper huge, like somewhere around there, you know, the garage rock thing sort of hit its tail end, and then there wasn't a next thing. Rock didn't go away. Rock, you know, there were plenty of people out there making rock, but it just, the next big mainstream thing just didn't sort of, I don't know if it's because like the popular mainstream sort of media didn't have a place for rock, or if there was just like a lack of creativity, or I don't know. Like I have a feeling we'll be trying to chase that down for ages to kind of figure out what happened there. But yeah, I don't know. It sort of feels like rock, at least in a mainstream kind of sense, in a grand spectacle sort of idea. I don't know. It just sort of, it never went away, but it stopped becoming, you know, it no longer had its place at the table, so to speak. And again, because we're not entirely out of that yet, because there sort of is, again, even now, there isn't like a sort of, oh, okay, if you're into like mainstream music, you know, if you listen to Christina, you know, back in the TRL days, like, okay, if you listened, if you get your pop from, say, Britney Spears and your rap from like, you know, Puff Daddy, you know, chances are if you were listening to rock, it was probably like, oh, Korn or Papa Roach or whatever was making the big, you know, whatever was making the big charts in that success. You know, these days it's like, okay, you get your pop from, I don't know, Charlie XCX or whatever. You get your hip hop from like Cardi B or whatever. Where do you get your rock from? There still isn't like an answer to that in that respect. And I don't know. Maybe rock could totally come back. Again, we're seeing some decent strides this very year. Again, Slipknot, not only did their album critically score, it sold really well. It's made a decent appearance on the Billboard charts too, which surprised
three number one albums in a row.
Yeah, exactly. Like that was super impressive. And again, Tool came. That's one thing that's been somewhat encouraging. Tool came around and knocked Taylor Swift out of the number one spot. I didn't think it was going to happen. Like, I could have sworn up and down. I figured it, you know, I honestly figured it'd come in at number three because that new Lana Del Rey record, that Norman Fucking Rockwell record, actually ended up being, A, it's a pretty damn good record. And B, again, you know, it's Lana Del Rey. She's, you know, she's out there. You know, she is the mainstream. But Tool came around and got them both in the first place position. So rock is... Again, it's starting to sort of make slow little nudges. I don't want to say it's a comeback. It probably isn't. I don't know. I don't want to call it. But at the same time, we're seeing more success than we've seen in like a long stretch of time. Like 5 years ago, to imagine a rock band being number one on the Billboard charts, I don't know if it wasn't a new Green Day record or like the White Stripes reuniting or something like that, it would have been unfathomable. And it's already happened more times this year than I think we've expected. So, but again, at the same time, it's also concerning.
By older bands.
By other bands. By older bands too, no less though. So again, it's also like, oh, okay, this is cool. But again, there isn't that new scene. There isn't that new flavor. There isn't that new biggest thing in the goddamn world in the rock scene right now. So it's like, I don't know what even... Because I get that question too, you know, oh, what do you think is going to be the next thing to break out big? What's going to be the next new hotness? It's like, oh, I don't know, dude. We haven't had hotness for a long time. I don't know what to tell you.
Well, I think there's big things, but big within this realm. You know, you look at a band what a band like Ghost has done. You look at a band like Bring Me the Horizon, and they're moving into arenas and... You know, but it, you know, you haven't really seen that success on the record sales side, at least in the States. You know, to the level that some of these other acts. But you know, I think it really, the biggest difference is the shift in culture. Is it's more focused around individuals as opposed to group dynamics. So even in hip hop back in the day, it was always a group. It was N.W.A. Yeah. It was you know, Cypress Hill. Oh, yeah. It was, Tribe Called Quest. It was a really group oriented. And over the years, hip hop went away from that and became more about solo artists. And I think the way younger people look at musicians and the people created, they really see it as a dynamic of one. And so it's really about having a dynamic personality. And I was just watching this Travis Scott documentary, which actually... Finn recommended there, and his shows look like metal shows and hardcore shows. Like they're like pits and people. He's like going ape shit on stage, and it feels like the personality type that would have been a rock musician or a metal musician 20 or 30 years ago. Like he's wearing like Pantera shirts. He's wearing an Inflame shirt in there. And so his energy and the rebelliousness is more, you know, what we would think of like a Marilyn Manson, maybe, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And I think those types of personalities just aren't the type of person that would have become a Marilyn Manson 20 years ago is now going into other scenes and genres. And it kind of represents very similar ideals and the anger and the passion and the being a rebel and all that shit that we think of as being rock and roll kind of hallmarks are just being expressed in other fields, you know? Yeah. Even someone like Post Malone, for example, who is like...
Yeah, I was actually just going to bring him up, actually, if you didn't. Yeah, because I've heard the exact same thing. I've heard the exact same thing from a lot of the people I know who have attended Post Malone shows. They say it's the exact same aesthetic, you know? The music certainly doesn't sound like a lot of that sort of idea, but that's the thing. He's getting pits formed at his shows. People are like going crazy. The show has this whole metal sort of aesthetic to it. It's very like, I don't know, that sort of thing you would normally associate with a rock or a metal show isn't, it's still around and it still exists, but it isn't like, again, these guys who are making music that is very far outside of rock are bringing that experience to those people, or those people are seeking it out at these other sort of, you know, places. So Yeah, I don't know. It's weird. I've heard like all of Post Malone. I listen to every Post Malone album. I do not know where would you mosh. Where the hell do you mosh at beer bongs and Bentleys? I don't know, but apparently people are doing it. I've seen people do it. So,
in that documentary, I didn't hear a ton of Travis Scott's music, but people were definitely going off and feeling it. And it's, you know, listen, I think as someone on the kind of other end of it, meaning I've been doing this for a really long time and want to, you know, I'm just never going to be that guy who puts his head in the sand. It's like, nope, I'm just going to listen to my Use Your Illusion from 25 years ago. Listen, I'm always going to listen to that stuff, but I always want to have a feel for what's going on. Not because I want to emulate it like creatively, like, oh, I got to stay current, so I got to have a trap beat on the next record or something. It's not that. Yeah. It's just, you know, I want to understand what's happening in the world and see if I can kind of get through my biases, because as you get older, your brain doesn't really want to like get into new shit. It wants to like almost see it through the prism of like it being inexplicable or noise. And even me, I was watching that Travis Scott song. I'm like, this motherfucker ain't even singing. He's just got he's got the auto tune, and I see other people in the studio doing the music. What does he do? And like, you know, and that's me. It's a little haterism and it's a little reality, but
I feel and that's especially a big thing I have to look out for from my end of things as a critic, because that's a trap you can very easily fall into when you're listening to all this new stuff and you're listening to all these, you know, you're listening to all these new artists and you're trying to actually break it down as to, okay, why does this work? Why doesn't this work? You have to be careful so that you aren't getting so stuck in what your perception of what rock has to be or what, you know, the genre you have to keep an open mind about things, or else, you know, you can totally find yourself. I've caught myself doing this from time to time, being like, oh, I don't, you know, you're the old man shaking your cane at the stick, or you're that one clip from The Simpsons, you know, you know, I was with it, but then they changed what it was. Now what's it is weird and strange to me. You know, especially from, you know, this, you know, that's a big part of the reason why, you know, why I do like to stay connected and why I do listen to a lot of stuff that's outside of my genre, because, you know, you have to step out of your comfort zone in order to properly understand what's going on out there and to stay connected to what's happening in music and what people are getting drawn to and what, you know, why people are gravitating towards the stuff they're gravitating. You know, you have to, people like to decry, like, you know, the scene and, you know, all the stuff the stuff that's popular right now, but you do need at least a basic understanding of it, you know, in order to actually comment on it. At least I feel, at least you should at least give it a chance, you know?
Yeah, listen, I'm all about open-mindedness and preaching that line, but Crash, I think it's a good time to wrap it up. I want to really appreciate and thank you for coming on the show, and it's been a lot of fun. Hopefully we illuminated some points about this new Tool record. I think it's really inspiring, and hopefully it'll cause some younger bands to step outside themselves and be experimental and realize that there's no rules. If people want to find you, how do they find your content?
Well, I am on YouTube at The Rock Critic. You can look me up on all my socials at @TehRockCritic, Twitter, Patreon, Facebook, etc. I had to go with Teh Rock Critic, T-E-H Rock Critic, because someone is sitting on The Rock Critic, and they will not give it up no matter what. But guys, if you want to find me, most of my stuff is on YouTube. Just look for The Rock Critic. And like I say, Teh Rock Critic, if you want to check out all my socials and all that fun stuff. I have a Patreon if you would like to check that out as well. But yeah, again, Doc, thank you very much for having me on the show. I'm glad. It's always fun to talk about Tool. I always love talking about this band. And yeah, again, thank you so much for having me on. Always a pleasure, dude.
Anytime, brother. You take care, all right?
You too. Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.